was an extraordinary thing to witness, you know, an American president on the move and what he brings with him. The soldiers, the backup, the cooks, you know, the translators, the doctors, this whole apparatus. And I remember, it was at that moment, I remember reading what it was like to travel with Marcus Aurelius and how he had the comitatus with him. All the same people who traveled on Air Force One would be traveling with the emperor.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Netta Ulaby. This week, Colin Murphy reads from Are We Rome? Murphy believes we are, but in ways that might be surprising. It's not America's military might or decadent lifestyles that concern him. It's that America, like Rome, seems to see itself as the center of the world, leaving us blind to what's beyond our borders. Like Rome, Murphy says, we're now putting more public tasks in private hands, hiring fewer police, for example, and more security guards. The author warns this is exactly how the gears of government break. Murphy's interests are eclectic. His previous books include Rubbish, an anthropological study of garbage, The World According to Eve, about women and the Bible, and a collection of essays aptly named Just Curious. But Murphy is even better known as an unflappable editor who spent two decades helping define The Atlantic Monthly. He moved to Vanity Fair last year. Murphy does see a crucial difference between Rome and America. Where Rome was all about self-satisfaction, he says Americans seek self-improvement. It's this quality, he believes, that may make it possible for us to reinvent ourselves rather than to fall. This reading of Are We Rome? Took place in May 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you so much. I called this book Are We Rome? Just so that there was no mistake about what the question at the heart of this book really is. I suppose I could have tried for something more lyrical, and in fact I did. I was dissuaded from it. But that really does get at the core of my, and I think our, preoccupations. I'm asking this question for two reasons, and I think Americans ask this question for two reasons. One of them is historic. From the very beginning of the Republic, the comparison of Rome and America has been on our minds. America was a republic that broke away from a monarchy. Rome was a monarchy that evolved into a republic. The founding fathers were very concerned about what had happened to the Roman Republic. Why had it become a tyranny? They were concerned lest something similar happen to our own young republic. The idea of checks and balances comes from Rome. Certain ideas of public virtue, arguably long lost, come from Rome. George Washington's rules of civility have an analog in the rules of behavior that elite Romans lived by. The architecture of the Capitol, which you see every day, is Roman to its core. So there's a very deep kind of Roman gene pool in the United States that just goes way, way back. And so does the concern about empire. But the events since 1989, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, since the emergence of the United States as the world's sole superpower, really bring this comparison home. Now, really for the first time, you have a situation where the United States, you know, is, without competition, the wealthiest, the most complex, and the most powerful nation on the earth, and that is pretty much what Rome was in the West, at least. So that comparison between the two places comes up pretty naturally, and you hear it among the columnists and the pundits, and you hear it coming up in two different ways. You hear a kind of triumphalist version of this, which is, yeah, we are the new Rome, and they had the Pax Romana, and it's time for a Pax Americana. It's time for us to assert our will in the world in ways that we think are right, and we should embrace that burden, you know, with fervor and moral certitude. And then you hear another group, and I'm simplifying, of course, that is worried about taking that course, that that would prefer what George Bush in his debates with Al Gore called a humble foreign policy, and that at least was wary of bestriding the world too much like a colossus. So this debate, too, is why the question, are we Rome, comes up. And as I'll go on to explain, there are a lot of other reasons why it should come up that don't really involve military power. Let me just tell you the genesis of this book, really in a very proximate sense. Why did I decide to do this now? In the summer of 2004, I took a plane to Ireland, and the plane landed at Shannon Airport about an hour after George Bush had arrived for one of the summit meetings. And as we drove down the tarmac, the pilot said to us, if you look out the right side of the plane, you'll see something that you may never again see in your life. And what it was both Air Force Ones had arrived and were parked nose to nose. And they had already been surrounded by concertina wire. And U.S. troops were inside the concertina wire. There were, you know, anti-missile stations. And up on the customs area of Shannon Airport, there were guards. And then when we finally were able to get our car and we tried to drive north, the roads were blocked off. They must have mobilized the entire Irish police force. The Irish tanks, such as they were out on the roads. It was an extraordinary thing to witness, you know, an American president on the move and what he brings with him, the soldiers, the backup, the cooks. Air Force One can serve a meal for 2,000 people. You know, the translators. You know, the doctors. This whole apparatus, and I remember. It was at that moment I remember reading a great book about the Roman emperor by a scholar named Fergus Millar, in which I think he describes Marcus Aurelius and what it was like to travel with Marcus Aurelius and how he had the comitatus with him, which is the group of people that if it were in America, it would be the group of people that had the email designation EOB or EOP for Executive Office of the President. It's all the same people who travel on Air Force One would be traveling with the emperor. And this would be a group of, you know, many thousands traveling across the countryside. This correspondence between what I was witnessing at Shannon and this memory of the progress of Marcus Aurelius through the countryside just made me think that maybe now was a moment to write this book. I started off wary of facile comparisons between Rome and America. They're made all the time, and therefore the natural reaction is to think, well, there must not be anything to it. And I began by, of course, you know, doing a lot of reading and compiling, I think, a kind of rough ledger of comparisons between Rome and America before settling on a handful of issues that I think we really ought to be focused on. And so the one passage that I'd like to read to you is the passage in which I describe this ledger book. And then I will stop and I will briefly explain what I think the half dozen or so really core similarities are, and then open it up to you for your thoughts and disagreements or hosannas. So I began with the question, are we Rome? One way to answer the question is by assembling a crude ledger book of comparisons. My own would start as follows. Leaving aside the knotty and partly semantic issue of what an empire is and whether the United States truly is one, Rome and America are the most powerful actors in their worlds by many orders of magnitude. Their power includes both military might and the soft power of language, culture, commerce, technology, and ideas. Tacitus said of the seductive amenities brought to Britain by Rome, the simple natives gave the name of culture to this factor of their enslavement. Rome and America are comparable in physical size. The Roman Empire and its Mediterranean lake would fit inside the 3 million square miles of the lower 48 states, though not with a lot to spare. Both Rome and America created global structures, administrative, economic, military, cultural, that the rest of the world and their own citizens came to take for granted, as gravity and photosynthesis are taken for granted. Both are societies made up of many peoples, open to newcomers, willing to absorb the genes and lifestyles and gods of everyone else, and to grant citizenship to incoming tribes from all corners of the earth. And because of this, the identities of both change organically over time. Romans and Americans revel in engineering prowess and grandiosity. Whenever I see the space shuttle standing upright and inching slowly on its crawler towards the launching pad, I think back to the Rome of Hadrian's day and the gargantuan statue of the sun, as tall as the shuttle, being dragged into place by 24 elephants. Romans and Americans can't get enough of laws and lawyers and lawsuits. They believe deeply in private property. They relish the ritual humiliation of public figures. Americans through comedy and satire, talk radio and court TV. The Romans through all of these things, through vicious satire to be sure, but also by means of the censoria nota, the public airing name by name of everything the great men of the time should be ashamed of. Both Romans and Americans accept enormous disparities of wealth and allow the gap to widen. Ramsay MacMullen, one of the most prominent modern historians of Rome, has said that 5 centuries of imperial social evolution can be reduced to 3 words: fewer have more. Both Romans and Americans treat the nouveau riche with lacerating scorn, perhaps concealing hints of admiration. Both see themselves as a chosen people, and both see their national character as exceptional. Both recover from colossal setbacks, and both endure periods of catastrophic leadership. Though when it comes to murderous insanity, some of Rome's emperors set the bar very high. Both Rome and America look back to an imagined, nobler, simpler past, and both see the future in terms of manifest destiny. The Romans spoke of having been granted imperium sine fine, an empire without end. The American dollar bill uses Rome's own language and words derived from Virgil to proclaim a novus ordo seclorum, a new order of the ages. But Rome, in all its long history, never left the Iron Age, whereas America, in its short history, has already leapt through the Industrial Age to the Information Age and the Biotech Age. Wealthy as it was, Rome lived close to the edge. Many regions were one dry spell away from famine. America enjoys an economy of abundance, even surfeit. It must beware the diseases of overindulgence. Rome was always a slaveholding polity, with the profound moral and social retardation that this implies. America started out as a slaveholding polity, and decisively cast slavery aside. Rome emerged out of a city-state and took centuries to fully let go of a city-state's methods of governance. America, from very early on, began to administer itself as a continental power. Rome had no middle class, as we understand the term, whereas for America, the middle class is our core social fact, our ballast, our gyroscope, our compass. Rome had a powerful but tiny aristocracy and entrenched ideas about social pecking order. Even at its most democratic, Rome was not remotely as democratic as America at its least democratic, under a British monarch. In Roman eyes, the best way to acquire wealth was the old-fashioned way, and still not a bad way, by inheriting it. The Romans looked down on entrepreneurship, which Americans hold in the highest esteem, and despised manual labor. Rome desired foreign colonies and protectorates and moved aggressively to acquire them. America, with few exceptions, prefers to extend its reach by other means. Rome was economically static. America is economically transformative. For all its engineering skills, Rome generated few original ideas in science or technology. America is a hothouse of innovation and creativity. Despite its deficiencies, as we may perceive them, Rome flourished as a durable culture for more than 1,000 years and acted as a great power for 6 centuries. Whether America has that kind of staying power remains to be seen. So that is how I started off that crude ledger book of comparisons. And in the end, I think somewhat to my surprise, I came to the conclusion that, in fact, there are some macro similarities between Rome and America that are really worth paying attention to. Yes, there are 1,000 differences. And yes, some of those differences are really existential and important, and we need to bear them in mind. But the similarities are important, too. Sometimes a similarity can be enough to tilt you in enough of a bad direction. One of them has to do simply with the nature of the capital. I'm not a stranger to Washington. I lived here for about 10 years, worked at the Smithsonian, and so I've known this place for a long time. It's not news to you that this is in many ways an artificial place, as Rome was an artificial place. It was not a seat of industry. It was not producing anything except administration. It was absorbing the wealth from all over the empire. Everything somehow depended on the revenue that was coming into Rome. So it was artificial, and it also thought of itself as the center of the world. I don't know if they used the phrase about, you know, the most important man in the most important city in the world to refer to the emperor the way they do the president, but it had that frame of mind. Something about the artificiality of the capital and the belief in its centrality is very similar. Related to that is the sense of the outside world. If you're going to see yourself as the center of the world, you may be led to think that the rest of the world doesn't matter all that much. This is not a Washington problem, it's an American problem. I was reading just the other day about some of the new National Geographic polls about what Americans know about the rest of the world. Of course, we know nothing. They always seem to add new questions just to make the ignorance seem even worse. You know, which direction do you have to go to get from Australia to Japan? You know, 75% say south. And but this inability to actually get outside America and see us as others see it, or to think that the minds of people who are not Americans are different, is a real drawback. The Romans had this drawback too, presuming that really they were the world. Why did it matter what others thought or how others behaved? This led them into some real troubles. The Battle of Teutoburg Forest is one great example where they completely underestimated a primitive barbarian enemy and lost three entire legions. So the outside world is another problem, the way we in Rome view it. A third has to do with borders and assimilation. Both Rome and America were concerned about borders. But it's a complicated concern, because both Rome and America were also interested in the people coming into the empire. Rome and America were the most successful assimilationist societies that the planet has ever known. Roman culture for its time was so attractive, so well organized, and offered so much to people who came under its sway, that it made willing converts. It didn't need a huge army to keep order. People were willing to buy into the order. And this lasted for a long period of time. Rome was a society that butted up against so-called barbarians. Political correctness even infects history now. Barbarians is not always a term that is used. But they were butting up against barbarians. They were absorbing barbarians and doing all this very successfully for 500 or 600 years. Before things began to get out of kilter. And America is very much an analog to this. I sometimes think that we are not as aware of our power in this regard to assimilate other people I think we are too fearful of our fragility. A further similarity has to be is one that that Carla alluded to, and that is privatization. Who wields public power? In this country, there has been something recognizably called a public sector for a long period of time. It seems to me that with each passing year, there's that sector shrinks. More and more government functions are being given to corporations or semi-private entities, somehow privatized, usually in the name of efficiency. And I don't mean to impute any invidious motives here, but it has been happening, and it's sewer systems and prisons and parts of the military and so on. Rome experienced some of the very same thing. Eventually, it came to the point where every government function required you to spend money for it to serve you, or the government, for its part, had to pay some private entity in order to accomplish some government objective. You can argue, I suppose, that this is just market mechanisms, but it does have one big effect. It detaches government power from government will. And when a time of crisis arises, when you want someone at the center to be able to say, let's come together, we need to accomplish this objective, let's mobilize all the parts of the government, and suddenly you realize that this gear is no longer connected to, that mechanism, and this gear is no longer connected. This is what can happen over a long period of time. We do see this in the military, which is a fifth area. And Rome and America both faced a very similar problem, which was they had militaries that were too small for the jobs that were being given to them and too large to be something that they really wanted to pay for. One result was to give some of the responsibilities to private, today we would say private contractors, perhaps, and back then they would say Visigoths, Huns. In some ways, Conan the Barbarian is really Conan the contractor. When Alaric sacked Rome in 410 AD, people forget that he had for a long time actually been a contractor for the Roman military. So it was like you're being sacked by your contractor. Finally, there's the complexity problem, and that is it's a problem that's faced by any entity that just becomes so large that it loses sight of everything it's touching. This can happen to big families. It can happen to big corporations, and it certainly happens to big polities. You forget, and if you have this frame of mind where you're just looking at yourself all the time, you forget that every action that you take in the world is touching something, and you don't even know what it's touching. Who knows when Osama bin Laden was first touched by the United States or any of the other things that that we touch? But you're touching thousands or millions of things, and all of those things can touch you back, but you're not aware of it. How can you keep track of it? Rome had this problem, and we have this problem. Any complex system will have this problem. It's not an America and Rome issue. It's a problem with any complex system, but you really see it with Rome, and it bedeviled them and surprised them. So let me stop right here. At some point, perhaps someone will raise a question about differences. And we can talk about differences because they are substantial, but I thought I would start with the parallels that I do think hold up. So with that, over to anyone here.
You didn't talk a lot about economics and. I'm curious as to what your view is, the things that are developing over the last 5 or 10 years, our debt, our failure to borrow. the overall direction of things, putting ourselves in a position of dependency with the Middle East and China. And what is your view about America decline in reference to the economy?
There were a number of issues that I did not address explicitly for what I hope is the good reason that it's hard to make a direct comparison between Rome and America. And economics is one of them. Rome did not have the tools that America has. It was very primitive in that respect. There was no such thing as deficit spending, for instance. They could always go to a new province. They could find a place that had gold, and this was a very effective way of getting more money. I mean, if you wanted to mint more money, you literally minted more money, and you could perform other tricks. You could inflate the economy by reducing the amount of, you know, silver and gold in your coinage and so on. And they did all of these things, as any government will play around, you know, in order to cheat. But they were not comparable in so many ways that I don't think I can give you an answer to the question in the terms that you're probably looking for.
Just one last thought. From what you were saying earlier, it seemed like they were particularly static as compared to the dynamism that's in the global economy right now, and the U.S. is part of that. And it seems like these examples you just gave, I think, illustrate that.
Yes, there are many theories as to why Rome was as static as it was. You know, it was an agrarian society, basically, from start to finish. Didn't have big factories. It had some factories and so on. Why was this the case? And, of course, one big answer to this would be slaves. If you can just have people doing work for you instead of machines, labor-saving devices, might that be a reason why, you know, the entire technological level is, you know, doesn't advance? So that certainly seems plausible to me as one reason, and it would explain why so many of the Germanic tribes, for instance, were out in front in terms of technology.
I was interested how you would see pride and arrogance not only among elites but among the common people in both Rome and America, as far as what it meant to be a Roman and what it means today to be an American. And I also was curious how you see the variety of religion and religious experiences in both the Roman Empire and the American Empire.
Boy, those are both fascinating questions. Let me just begin with the second one. As someone who was raised a Catholic, when you come away with a very jaundiced view of the Roman view of religion, lions and all that, and you don't actually get the real core truth, which is that much like the Ottoman Empire, the Roman Empire was a fairly tolerant place when it came to religion. It did make certain demands. It did demand that you acknowledge the divinity of the emperor, and if you were not willing to do that, then you had a big problem. But basically, there were two groups who would not do that, and initially both groups were small, Jews and Christians. But the other groups, and there were just many kinds of religions in the empire, were basically tolerated. Rome was, it was syncretic in its approach. It's, the more the merrier. You want your gods? Fine, put your gods in our temple. And it was a very effective way of co-opting other people. On the Roman citizenship question, Roman American comparisons are bedeviled by the time frame. Rome exists for 1,000 years. America is, as a state, as a country, is 200 years old. So what are you comparing? There is a time when to be able to say I am a Roman citizen, it carries an extraordinary force around the world. And then there comes a time after the Edict of Caracalla when the emperor says basically all free people in the empire are citizens, in which means that the uniqueness becomes somewhat less. I'm conscious in my own life of what being an American citizen abroad now entails. And it is not something that, I say it internally proudly, because I am proud to be an American citizen, but I don't have the same confidence that I should be wearing that citizenship, you know, on my backpack or whatever form of luggage I may be carrying now. And that many of you may have the same feeling.
Your book lists two Greek historians in the back, at least two, Kagan and Hansen, both of whom are also, one could say, instrumental in contriving the imperial philosophy of the present. Could you talk a bit about any arguments you have with contemporary historians and also about the relationship between Rome and Greece and whether you would see the relationship between America and Britain as the obvious parallel?
I wasn't looking for arguments with other historians. Kagan and Victor Davis Hanson are, you know, they're both terrific classicists, and their books are well worth reading. Both of them are to the right of where I would be, and Kagan's most recent book is making the argument that, well, you know, in a way, the United States has always been kind of an imperial power, and this is really in our blood, and you know, our instincts just go this way. And I think there's a lot to it. I think when someone like Kagan is being descriptive, he's actually got his finger on something that is very important. The one thing that I am somewhat wary about is making comparisons that are just too finely wrought. Sometimes the comparison between the Peloponnesian War, for instance, and modern United States, or really with any specific historical event. And I was trying to stay away from that and from ideological battles in what I was doing, in the hope that some other kind of broader, maybe not so ideological themes would emerge that aren't so much on people's radar screen. And I think the ones that I've mentioned here are, I mean, if not original, they're not the ones usually that are getting talked about. So thank you.
When you see the State of the Union address, and the first report you get is the number of applause and the ovations, do you make connections there? And what do foreigners think of us, and are we Rome?
That sounds like four questions, but they're all good ones. And it reminds what you say about the applause, it does remind me of the Roman practice of hiring people to applaud for you, which I have not done. And but.
So we're paying you.
Yeah, that's well, I hope so. But you know, your mention of the State of the Union message just reminds me of something really extraordinary about that event. When it's held, of course, in the House of Representatives, and you see the American flag, and on either side of the American flag you see these Roman symbols, the fasces, and what the fasces were these rods, and they were surrounding an axe. And then the rods were bound up with red thongs. And this has always been, in the United States from the very beginning, has held to be one of our great Republican symbols. And if you go to the Lincoln Memorial, for instance, Lincoln's hands are, one of them is grasping, the other one is like this on the Roman fasces. The old dime that some of us here remember, the Mercury dime, on the back of it, it had the Roman fasces. It's the same dime that now has Roosevelt and a Liberty torch. But when you're watching the State of the Union message, you see the fasces on either side. And what most people forget is what the fasces originally were, why they were a symbol of Republican Rome, because they were carried in front of the consuls, and they were used to dispense summary justice. The rods were for beating people, and the axe was for decapitating people. And this symbol, when it was carried by Rome abroad to its conquered territories, was a hated one I mean, you can imagine if we carried like lethal injection machines in front of American ambassadors or something, it was actually the fascists were sometimes used by Rome's enemies at moments of when they were victorious over the Romans, just to throw the victory back in their face, you know, to impale Roman heads on the axes and send them back to the Romans. So it has always struck me ironic to see the State of the Union message and to see the fascists there on either side of the American flag. I know it wasn't intended that way, but yes.
Do you see any parallel between the weakening of Congress in enforcing the Constitution and the War Powers Act, these sort of things, and the Roman Senate in the first century when the Republic dissolved under Caesar and Pompey, when the Senate became very weak, to Cicero's dismay? Do you see any parallels?
I sure do, but I'll have to tell you, I was on a radio program the other day, and a caller called in to talk about this tussle between the executive and the legislative, and asked essentially the same question that you were asking. And before I was able to give my view, he said, I mean, I can't believe the way Congress is just grabbing at the president's power. And so I was flummoxed.
It's not the same question.
No, he had it. I mean, he was upside down, but in my view. But the question you're asking about the executive and the legislative branches, I mean, this is the very question that that the Founding Fathers were wrestling with Rome in mind, at the Constitutional Convention. They did not want this to happen, and and feared it would, and they knew that in Rome's case that it had. Cicero had thought that the Roman system, with its division of powers, he called it like a well-trimmed boat, mm-hmm. He thought that this was, you know, that it was permanent and stable. This was the way things, we could sail along this way for a long period of time. And it wasn't true. And I do see a lot of parallels nowadays with the reluctance, if that's what it is, inability, if that's what it is, of Congress to put its foot down for its own power, regardless of what its view on certain issues is. If you want a fun way to get access to some of these issues in a Roman context, read a book called Rubicon by Tom Holland, which is a pretty historically fastidious novel, and it's about this very topic. So,
I can't resist bringing up Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. I'm sure you must have expected something.
Who? Long.
That's the answer to my question. In his last 20 pages of his work, he outlined four principal causes as to why he believed, after his massive study, led to the decline and fall of Rome. And he said the most serious of them all was internal dissension. Do you see some sort of an analogy in America, some sort of an analog of this in America? Not that I wish to suggest that there's a decline and fall, but that if there was one in Rome, and given all the parallels that you've pointed out between Rome and America, this most serious reason that led to the collapse of Rome, according to Gibbon anyway, is there an analog of that in America? Thank you.
Well, I have to say, the number of people who have referred to something that they've read in the last 20 pages of Gibbon is very small. I'm suspicious of any, you know, single silver bullet theory of anything, and Gibbon brings up, as you well know, many other, not many, but a handful of other big contributory factors. There's the whole role of Christianity, which drained talent and money from the empire. There's the sheer ponderousness of the empire, this thing that collapses of its own weight. there was a German historian a few years ago who decided he was going to make a list of all the reasons that have ever been adduced for the fall of Rome, and he came up with 210 different reasons, including impotence caused by water in the baths being too hot. I think in some ways explaining decline is both simpler and more complicated than this. Simpler in the sense, well, complicated in the sense that it's many things are required, and simpler in the sense that there are always many things around to affect you, and which actually gets to the issue of, you know, what was the fall of Rome? It was, you know, really it was not the cataclysm that we sometimes think. It was not outsiders battering down the walls, tearing civilization down, and putting an entire civilization suddenly to the torch. It was a very slow. Oh, it was fast in some places, but mostly it was a slow evolution over many, many generations. Sometimes people wouldn't have even noticed that it was happening in where they lived. You know, if you told people in certain parts of the empire, if you said to them, in 30 years after Rome, fell, did you hear about the fall of Rome? They wouldn't know what you were talking about. Their lives, wouldn't have appreciably changed at all. So, in any event, I'm not sure that I would agree with Gibbon on that. On that one answer, but I sure wish I could write like him. If you have not read Gibbon, you should just pick it up and read it for 100 pages. He is one of the most stately and the slyest and the funniest writers in the English language. I put him alongside Shakespeare in the King James Bible as the great formative stylistic documents of our language.
Well, based on just the last thing you just said, it reminded me of something I've heard a couple of times. Somebody once compared the fall of the Roman Empire more to the fall of the Soviet Union, that it was this huge, very heavily centralized, top-heavy military power that it turned out none of its citizens especially liked very much towards the end, and then it just sort of collapsed of its own weight as soon as somebody, touched a little. And I was wondering if you felt there was any aptitude to that comparison.
I'm sure that in part there is. The collapse of the Soviet Union was fast by comparison. One of the great things that the study of Rome always does is it improves your time sense. It allows you to understand, how slow revolutionary change can be. From our point of view, we already know what happened, and we know conclusively that something happened, and we forget the fact that it happened over 200, 300 years. All those waves that you see of Goths and Vandals, it looks like a football play, and you think it all happened within a period of months or years and so on, but in fact this is playing out over a long period of time. I think the comparison with the Soviet Union probably holds up if you don't push it too far. Mm-hmm. Some of it probably was like that. This is a construct that fell apart over centuries, and in different ways. Sometimes the imperial power withdrew its forces, as it did with Britain. Sometimes it said to outsiders, we're tired of staving you off. Why don't you come in? Take Burgundy. You run it. It may not have involved all that many people, but they still had their armies, and they were in charge, and maybe things were left otherwise more or less stable. And you do that with 10 or 15 different groups. And over time, suddenly you wake up and you realize, you got something different going on here.
We're talking about the end of the Roman Empire as the slow and steady, dissolution of central Roman authority and division of Roman culture and the Roman people. But, that happened centuries after Rome became an imperial power, its own sole superpower, at least in the world as they knew it. And prior to that, the moment that they stepped onto the world stage was really the centuries leading up to the Common Era, and it was at that moment that their republic fell apart, and they turned into a military dictatorship that lasted for centuries more. But prior to that, they'd been a republic, at least according to their own traditions, for about twice as long as we have been so far, and they held it just as dearly. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about, you know, the fall of the Roman Republic.
And well, it sounds like there's the dum-da-dum-dum music playing in your head, which it plays often in mine, in mine too. You know, empire theorizing has a long history, and there's a lot of wonderful writing by people who know much more about this than I about why it is that certain places become empires and what impels them to become empires. But an awful lot of it is not by preordained will. You know, there's that famous phrase about England, how it acquired an empire almost by absence of mind. And in some ways, we've done the same thing. We didn't set out. I mean, sure, we've had imperialistic episodes, but we didn't set out with some master plan at the turn of the 20th century to say, hey, you know, by the end of the 20th century, maybe we should have a system where, you know, and you'd go down the list of what we have now. We just simply didn't do that. Things happened. We took advantage of certain opportunities. Responsibilities fell our way that we didn't ask for. We went and took charge of certain things that nobody asked us to take charge of. A combination of many factors is involved here. So, which is a long way of saying people, and I think this happened to some extent with Rome too, you end up with something that you didn't necessarily know you were going to be ending up with. And that comes with repercussions for how you govern yourself. And you're not necessarily anticipating those things either. I think that's some of what this country faces right now.
How do you think the corruption and in Roman government and the relationship between the government and the people compares to American government?
Well, I think they were actually a lot better at it, but we're catching up. There did come a point where it was impossible to get a job in the imperial bureaucracy without paying for it. And it was virtually impossible to get something done by the imperial government without paying for it, whether it's simple justice or a permit. So by the time the apparatus came tumbling down, at least in the West, it was a thoroughly corrupt institution. Or one could say it was a thoroughly market-oriented institution. And we are not there yet, and I hope we don't get there. I hope we it is one of the main points of my book is the importance of preserving a sense of public purpose and common purpose. And I mean, it's a great question, and if you're interested in pursuing this further, there's a wonderful book. It's maybe a little bit of a difficult book called Corruption and the Decline of Rome by Ramsay MacMullan. And one of the great things about this book is that at the very beginning he goes through all the different explanations for why Rome fell and then says, well, you know, I don't think any of them are good enough. I want to keep looking for one more explanation. And the one that he comes to finally is the one that really goes to your question about just having to pay for everything that government does. So thank you.
Thank you.
What does it mean that it fell?
Great question. In the technical sense, what it means is that there finally a person came to the throne and was not recognized as a legitimate emperor. There were at that time two emperors, one in the east and one in the west. And the one in the east would not, for the first time, recognize the one in the west as emperor. And so he became merely a king. And from that moment on, the Western Empire was a place of barbarian kingdoms. And there was no longer an emperor on the west. It's kind of a technicality, but it's always been accepted as the fall of Rome, and it's a great question.
Well, you can see why people didn't notice.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's right. It wasn't even on the federal page. But here's my view of why Americans are interested in this question right now. You know, to a certain extent, we've always had Rome on our minds, but put that aside. We're at one of these moments in our history, and there haven't been all that many of them, where we, as a people, need to ask ourselves some fundamental questions about what we are as a society and what our place is in the world. We have been needing to face this question ever since the fall of communism, ever since the Cold War template disappeared. We have not been very successful yet in figuring out the answer to this question. So there's a fork in the road, or many forks in the road. Whenever you are faced with the situation of having to make a decision about what direction do we go in, it invites you to ask, well, where does each one of these places end up? Does it end up like Rome? Does it end up like, you know, Denmark? And I think that's one reason why we have this kind of endpoint question on our minds.
You've partially answered my question, but I really would like to ask you whether there are conclusions you draw from your analysis about what you, Americans, should do to avoid ending up like the Romans.
Well, everybody has to buy this, and and it's all going to be okay. Yes, I do. I in my last chapter, I do hazard some thoughts about this. America is going to change radically. It's a truism. We've changed, you know, more radically between now and 1776 than Rome ever did in its entire history. And we've accommodated that change. We have somehow remained true to our values, to our essential values, not to our accidental characteristics during that period of time. So 500 years from now, we are going to be an unrecognizable place. If you dropped us, you know, any one of us, into that America, our jaws would drop. But I hope it will be the same kind of place in terms of its egalitarianism, its entrepreneurial spirit, its constitutional bedrock, and so on. And at the end of the book, although I have a lot of specific suggestions about how to maintain basically the core health of our polity, I point to a difference between Rome and America, and I think it's the fundamental one. Rome, especially among its elites, was ultimately a complacent place. Their motto could have been the Madison Avenue motto of, it doesn't get any better than this. That isn't our motto. Our motto is kind of the opposite. We're a middle-class people. We expect things to be getting better, not just for ourselves, but for the country as a whole. The people who come into our country expect this for themselves. It's why they're here. They expect it for their children. This attitude of non-complacency and of constant self-improvement, and the notion that things must always get better, that it's the job of being an American to get better, is a big difference. And that's where I place my hope. So, thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us. To hear more readings like this one, go to npr.org/booktour.